When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, we were fighting 5, 6, 7 times a day in direct contact with a very well-trained enemy force. I mean, it wasn't a matter of if we were going to get in a firefight that day. It was when and how often and for how long, some lasting up to 5 hours where we're slinging lead for that long. It's, I tell you, for me and for the Marine Corps in general, it really redefined what we knew about urban fighting.
Let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. We've got a special guest today, Scott Husing. You were both enlisted and officer in the Marine Corps, so I half trust you, I guess, right? But you started enlisted. That's the important part.
Yeah, you don't go back, I think, no, the other can't. Way. That'd be an interesting career path.
Could you get demoted? I think you can only get demoted back to first.
Never demoted. Yeah. But I did. I spent just over 4 years enlisted. And then even when I was in college, I stayed in the reserves as a machine gunner just to stay tied to, you know, what we do. And then, you know, I had no intention of going back on active duty. But a young sergeant gave me a phone call. His name was Sergeant Connor. I still remember his name out of Champaign, Illinois, and offered me a great opportunity. And, you know, some 24 years later, the rest is history.
What was the opportunity?
Well, I was planning on going to work for U.S. Federal Marshals, some sort of federal law enforcement. And he called me up. I had submitted a package. They have a program where you can go during 2 summers and then get your commission. But I wasn't really...
Was it called Green to Gold or some bullshit?
That's the Army term. This program is one of several commissioning programs the Marine Corps has. It's called the Platoon Leaders Course, where you go to OCS for 1 summer, then you go another summer. But I was thinking, man, that sounds like 3 boot camps, and I don't want to do 3 boot camps because I've already done one. So when a boat space opened up, he said if I came down, ran a PFT and got a physical, he could get me to OCS in January, and the rest is history. Because I'd always really wanted to give back. I love the Marine Corps. It was a, you know, big part of my life. And you know, from a kid that grew up in Waukegan, Illinois, where I barely graduated high school with a 1.24 GPA, did much better in college. But you can get this. I share that not as a self-deprecating testimony, man. It's really a testament to what military service provides and to try and show kids that struggle and inspire them that there's so many benefits of military service. And if I could come from that background, limited supervision growing up, and spent 24 years, retire as a major, and become a best-selling author, then there's hope.
Well, what was it, do you think, about your upbringing that made you not give a shit? Because I didn't care about high school either, but it was just, like, boring. I feel like there's a point of self-awareness that becomes dangerous when you don't have the guardrails, like you're talking about with the military or whatever it is, whether it's sports or career or, you know, some kind of project, whatever it happens to be. There's a point of self-awareness where you're like, I'm not going to use calculus. It's just not going to happen. So I'm not going to fucking pay attention to this old person trying to teach me this. You know what I mean? That's my brain being masculine and wanting to go out and fucking do crazy shit. You know what I mean? That's how it was for me. I wonder if does that resonate with you at all, or was it something else?
Oh, absolutely. I was a horrible student. It wasn't because I wasn't smart. Like many people, in the military community and veterans, they come from broken homes. Mm-hmm. I think that's the norm, not the rule. I think we're also born as some sort of protector. It doesn't mean you have to be a door kicker in Ramadi, Iraq, or jumping out of airplanes or flying jets. I think there's a people that are born into that. And when you have a lack of structure and regiment, I think we seek that out as humans. And people that join the military, I think they do form a very small segment of, you know, less than 0.5% that are willing to serve at such a very young age too, because I think that's something that most people don't realize. The 250 Marines that fought under my command in Ramadi, a year before that, they were probably playing high school football.
Yeah. Yeah. Or smoking weed.
Yeah.
Or both.
Yeah. Right. Not telling the recruiter to smoke weed.
Well, never tell the truth to the recruiter. I promise you.
No.
They're not telling you the truth, so don't tell them the truth. So you enlisted first.
Yes.
What was going through your mind when you decided to do that? And what year was it?
That was 1988.
Okay. So we were kind of in a lull between Grenada and Panama was the year after that. So we were kind of in a lull, militarily speaking.
Yeah. Right. I not being great in high school, I get a phone call from my buddy, pick up the phone from 662-3427. Mm-hmm. He says, "You got to come down here and meet these guys." I'm like, "Who?" He says, I joined the Marines. I said, "You did what?" And this was pretty astonishing from this guy, because he had was not really cut out for that. And, you know, up until that point, I was a horrible kid. I was a horrible student. I had a motorcycle, was my first car. Ran from the cops, got caught by the cops, drank underage, fighting, thrown in jail, got out of jail. And I went down and met these recruiters. And you know how it is when you go in, there's camouflage netting and they're all in their uniforms. And then they talk this mad game. And I really looked at these guys and I thought to myself, I have never met a group of risk takers like these guys, and it's a perfect fit for me, because that's who I was.
What do you think it is about risk taking that appeals to men, especially young men who are like trying to find purpose in their life? Because it's almost like we're taking one part of, the service and selfless sacrifice kind of situation. And well, that's what I'm attracted to. It's the jumping out of planes, it's the kicking doors, it's whatever, right? That really appeals to us. It may just be a evolutionary biological trick to get us to do stuff, but it is very appealing.
That's a good question.
I wonder what it is, right? Because it's not just, it doesn't just manifest in service. It's also in sports or just fucking hanging out and doing dumb shit.
I think maybe that risk is that sensory input when you're kind of a seeker, or you need a lot of high input. I think that putting yourself in those risky situations or dangerous situations, and let's face it, that being in the military is not like working at IBM or State Farm Insurance. Yeah. There is inherent risk in everything we do, from entry-level training to the highest end of the spectrum, being in combat. And but I think that, again, that small segment of population who are protectors, there's something in their DNA that makes them put themselves in those positions.
And what did you think? So I'm assuming you didn't deploy as a Marine, unless it's on a MEU, right? And your first enlistment.
After Desert Shield, Desert Storm, I kind of figured out the error of my ways and I hung up my rifle, joined the reserves as a machine gunner, and did much better in college.
So you're an 0311 and you became an 0331.
Yeah, 0331. Okay. And then I ran into Sergeant Connor and, decided being an officer was the best path. And, I still wanted to be in the infantry. So I was lucky, because that's the thing they don't tell you as an officer candidate, that it's just being an officer should be good enough for you.
Yeah.
And there's, the military occupational specialty is 0302, but they mess with you when you're going through training. There's a lot of jobs with threes and twos in them, so you got to do well.
Yeah, you might end up in a chem engineering company or some bullshit like that, and that's leaf eaters, right? You don't want to be around those.
Well, they do it too, where there's equal distribution of smartness and dumbness in the Marine Corps and every military services officers included in that algorithm that they use to place us throughout the service. I was very fortunate to stay in the infantry and be selected to go to the infantry officers course. And it's tough. It's a real bastion that tests young lieutenants, and we don't advertise it. Like, other branches of service. So,
yeah, that's true. Yeah, you don't hear much
about Marine officers. Very secretive about how we train as Marine officers in the infantry.
Well, you were, so you go through whatever it is you go through. It's not OCS, I would imagine.
We go through OCS, then the basic school, then we go right across the street to the infantry officers course.
And it's not the same. So we have IOBC, I think. Infantry officer basic course is what the Army calls it.
Yep.
And but you guys have SOI, so we just do OSIT for infantry people. It's basic, and then you go right into A school and do it all at one time. And I think the idea behind it is you're getting infantry training for the entire sequence instead of just getting lead feeder basic and then having to go relearn everything as an infantry man. But it's how long is it for you guys?
Well, the thing
is, you were prior enlisted. Did you have to go back to basic?
Right. No, you don't go back. Right? You don't go basic, but you do have to go to officer candidate school, which is different than boot camp. Boot camp is a building process. Yeah. OCS is an evaluation process. Mm. Do you have the minimum requirements to potentially lead Marines in combat?
And it's mostly run by staff NCOs.
All enlisted, yes.
Like E7s and higher, I believe, right?
There's some E6s.
Okay, so it's staff NCOs.
Yeah, staff NCOs are higher. And you go through OCS, and then you go across the street to the basic school, which is 6 months. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Marine Corps trains every single person as a rifleman.
Right.
Like, you're a rifleman first, then you get your follow-on school. But I like it that you mentioned that. Because throughout my career, I've always reminded officers and staff NCOs how we're trained. Because, you know, you get the as a higher level commander, you always get the staff NCOs that love to make the lieutenant jokes and this, that, or lieutenant's not doing this. I say, hey, man, you got to remember, everything they learned about officer, and myself included, came from a staff NCO.
Right.
So you're part of the training process, and that training never stops your entire career. Whether it's 4 years or 24 years, you're the guys that train them.
I wonder if part of that isn't to get them used to taking instructions from E6s and E7s when they arrive at their unit, because you can have a very good potentialed officer and a shitty NCO, and you're going to get a shitty officer. That's just the way it works. Or you can have a headstrong officer sometimes that doesn't want to listen to their sergeants, and that's a problem as well. Yeah. But I feel like part of that process is specifically designed to make sure that lieutenants listen to sergeants. You know what I mean?
No, I agree with that.
You're getting used to it, which is a good thing, by the way. Well, it can be a good thing.
Well, the other thing too, and the Army does this as well. They just do it on a bigger scale. But you take your average staff NCO or maybe he's a sergeant, an E5, and he's at that point where he has to go out on a B billet where he's a recruiter or a drill instructor. And now you've got maybe a really great squad leader, a platoon sergeant. And he atrophies for about 3 or 4 years. So when you're a young lieutenant, you come in as like, all I see is, you know, Sergeant Holloway.
Yeah.
Like, I don't see the guy that was just out of his profession for 3 years. And he has to relearn a little bit, catch up with the new tactics, techniques, and procedures. Whereas that lieutenant, he's just come through the longest school, most professional school that the Marine Corps has to offer. So he really has the best knowledge. But it's a combination and that teamwork, I think, that makes units great.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you need that. It's funny to me. I don't know if this works the same way in a Marine infantry company, but the roles kind of flip-flop. When you go from lieutenant to captain and you take over a company, it seems like the roles flip-flop a little bit. Like, if I'm out with my platoon and I'm an E7, I'm pretty much like my lieutenant is doing a lot of administrative stuff, taking commands from higher and disseminating that stuff. But I'm leading the tactical force on the ground. That isn't the case when you're gunny or your first sergeant in the Marine Corps, but your first sergeant in the Army infantry, they're bullets and beans, right? Mm-hmm. And my commander's leading the tactical movements at that point. It kind of flip flops right there. Is it the same for your gunny or your first sergeant when you get into a Marine to the company level?
Yeah, the gunny runs the logistics. First sergeant handles personnel reporting,
right.
And then as a company commander, as a captain, your real job is to be a force supplier, like making sure that every single different person within that element has what they need to succeed on the battlefield, whether that's intelligence, logistics, ammunition, chow, mobility, and good quality of life too.
Yeah.
I mean, staying informed and providing information at all levels, I think.
But for Marines, though, you want to keep them a little pissed off.
right? Oh, that's part of our philosophy. We keep Marines...
Like, you don't say it out loud, but you do it as a matter of course, yeah. Right?
We are in a perpetual state of pissed offedness at every single point, I think. And I think that's by design.
Oh, yeah. Just it's definitely by design.
Keep us always complaining. If Marines aren't complaining, there's something vastly wrong with them.
Yeah, it's like the infantry in the Army is the same way, though. It's like, if you leave us sitting around too long, we're going to start fighting each other, or we're going to start throwing rocks at each other. Something's going to happen, right? You got to fucking, it's like the devil's hand.
Yeah. If there's an enemy to fight, they will fight each other. That's a fact.
That's good, though. So you're a lieutenant for a while, and then the wars start to kick off, and you become, you're a lieutenant, you're a platoon commander. We call them platoon leaders. You're a platoon commander over a FAST company, or in a FAST company, rather. I don't know that a lot of people outside the Marine Corps know what that is. So you can explain that?
So it's actually a captain's billet. So you're a captain.
So you were frocked? You were
I got promoted.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I'd already done 4 years as a lieutenant. Okay. And that was a B billet. And what was cool about being with a fleet anti-terrorism security team is, one, it's anti-terrorism. So we'd have other captains that would show up and they think they're going to be bungee cording through skylights. I'm like, no. Not counterterrorism. Anti-terrorism. And that organization within the Marine Corps actually works directly for Chief Naval Operations. And the Marine Corps is a department of the Navy. Yeah. So we have a very close relationship, but that's who we take our tasking from. And we are a 911 force within the Marine Corps, who's always the first to fight. And we're stationed around the world, pre-positioned. And they have a very specialized skill set. And the great thing about being a platoon commander in FAST company is normally there's another captain with you who's junior, but you're condition one the whole time. You're traveling around the world. You're in a lot of different remote locations. And to be quite honest, you're in command. So I had 3 years of command time with FAST, and then I kind of skirted the recruiting duty or going down to the drill field or a Pentagon tour, because I was very, very lucky, man, because I was either a Marine or I was leading Marines the entire 24 years I was in the Marine Corps.
How does that work with the deployments for a FAST company? Like, what's the decision-making process about where you are and when? Is it just like needs of the Navy, or how does that work?
Yes. They have units that are pre-staged around the world in the Pacific Rim, in the Mediterranean, and in continental United States. And then urgent tasking statements come from Chief Naval Operations. They'll request it, and then they'll get deployed. Mm. So, like, if you go back to, I don't know if you've had Mark on the show, Mark Geist, 13.
Not yet. No, I know Oz, though.
Yeah.
Good dude.
He is. But, when that whole event went down, there was a FAST company that was in Rota, but the response time to send them for the events that as they unfolded so rapidly, it probably wouldn't have been a utility. So I know there was a lot of consternation, like, why didn't the FAST team deploy to go down and support him? Like, that fight was over so fast, even though they were on a 5-hour tether.
Yeah,
someone didn't foresee that. That was the problem. Is those guys should have been flown down there in pre-stage at the embassy in Benghazi well before that, boiled over into the cauldron that it was.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you're on this FAST team for a while. That's pretty good experience, I would say, probably outside of just the normal platoon command, because you're not just moving around more and having to deal with that and dealing with a more dynamic environment. Look, not that a fucking infantry deployment is not dynamic, but this is for career building. It's probably because you're interfacing with a lot of different types of people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
With a lot of State Department officials, a lot of senior Navy. And as a young captain, you're briefing some senior level people. And then you're working with NSW. We train with the SEALs. We did interoperability with them and missions in the Mediterranean. And it's one of those jobs where here I am today, I'm cross-decking from a U.S. Navy destroyer, which doesn't have any Marines on it ever, to a whatever Icelandic flagged ship. And we're doing a ladder climb in Sea State 3 to safeguard, weapons parts to get into the Persian Gulf. So it was... it was pretty fascinating, and it was, again, a lot of risk.
Yeah, yeah.
But the group of guys that are there are all hand selected too. So as a platoon commander, it makes your job pretty easy.
It's hand selected by you?
They get hand selected by the Marine Corps.
Okay.
So they can go from entry level, straight out of boot camp, to the School of Infantry, to their secondary MOS. But then they have to get highly screened. There's more of a psychological screening and background. And then all of the NCOs are handpicked to go to Fast Company because of the level of responsibility. Mm. I mean, I would send guys off. Again, when you think of a sergeant in the Army or the Marine Corps, you don't really understand that that's a 22-year-old kid.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
and he's in charge of six other people.
He's in charge of, you know, 12 to 15 guys on a merchant marine ship or a commercial vessel, transiting the Straits of Gibraltar into, you know, Sigonella, and, you know, he's responsible for all the weapons and that whole team of Marines. So, yeah, it's a lot of responsibility for a young guy.
And then for you, the next step is you go to 2-4 and you take over command of a company. That's quite a bit different, right? Like, the role changes quite a bit. You have more of a personal relationship, I think, as a platoon commander, especially doing a slice job like you were doing. Probably you know those guys personally.
Yeah.
As a company commander, you try to, but it's a lot of dudes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we have a different relationship, I think, in the Marine Corps, too, than some of the other services. Mm. The Army is very similar to what we do, and I'm a big fan of the Army because, you know, I fought under 1-1 BCT in Ramadi. Mm. But when I found out I was going to 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, which is affectionately nicknamed the Magnificent Bastards, I was pretty happy. And they graduated me and a couple other guys early from school in Quantico, which is kind of our preparatory school to become a commander. Mm-hmm. And I didn't walk the stage to get my diploma or anything. Mm-hmm. I just went straight out, drove across the country, checked in on a Tuesday. On that Thursday, I took command. And then that next week, we were up in 29 Palms doing combat training, getting ready to go. And so it was baptism by fire for a lot of the guys. But I was really lucky again. I had a whole slew of sergeants and corporals and some of the staff NCOs that had been in Ramadi in 2004 when that fight started, which some call the first battle of Ramadi. Mm-hmm. And then there's a second battle of Ramadi in 06 where we fought again. But my position is it was a two-year battle in that city for the most part. But when we took command, we had a very, very intense workup cycle. I literally lived in my office. I found no utility in even getting an apartment out in town, and the Marines hated me for that, for sure, because I was never gone. But I think we had a really good opportunity to ramp up for the 15th MU, which at the time was the theater reserve for the Central Command in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot of factors, a lot of things going wrong and going badly in Iraq at the time for the president to commit the theater reserve, because that was it. With those 2,500 Marines that were afloat on those ships was us.
Yeah, we did the same. So my 82nd unit, we were the DRF-1 at the time, and they deployed us early to go to the surge. We took over Sadr City, basically, for about a year and a half. Same kind of deal. It's like, no, this is like a break in case of emergency situation, not a normal deployment to a previously occupied area. But I guess during that time from 06 to 08, that was like the meat and potatoes of that particular war. I think it was pretty rough over there. So you guys left in late 06, or when was it?
We took off in late 06. It was on November 10th, the Marine Corps birthday, when the MU commander stepped out on the flight deck of the USS Boxer and told us that we had just gotten orders to go into Iraq. And what happened was, because the MU is so big, a Marine Expeditionary Unit, there's a ground combat element of that goes from about 800 to 1,200 Marines when all of the enablers or support staff join us. But even then, they still chopped us up. Some of the units went up north to Haditha Dam. Some went over to Camp Korean Village. And then myself and my buddy John Smith, we got sent to Ramadi, which, you know, is during the surge. I always remind people that are listening to stuff like this that the surge in 06, things were going so badly for a lot of the units that it was like a giant game of whack-a-mole. You had insurgent forces popping up in one city like Fallujah or, you know, Baghdad. And, you know, we'd hammer them down into fine powder and they'd go to ground. Mm. And then they just wait till we got static and they'd pop up in another city and they'd kick some ass. And they're pretty good fighters. Mm. So when they flooded the battle space in 06 and 07 with an additional 20,000 troops of Marines and soldiers, it really allowed us to apply pressure in all those cities. And it just so happened that in 06, Ramadi's really where they wanted to fight. Mm. And, you know, we were fighting 5, 6, 7 times a day in direct contact with a very well-trained enemy force. I mean, it wasn't a matter of if we were going to get in a firefight that day. It was when and how often and for how long, some lasting up to 5 hours where we're slinging lead for that long. It's, I tell you, for me and for the Marine Corps in general, it really redefined what we knew about urban fighting because they were going at it. I mean, they were a very well-trained and determined enemy.
Right now, get up to 55% off your subscription when you go to babbel.com/citizen. This holiday season, if you're looking for a unique gift that inspires curiosity, travel, and culture, give yourself the gift of Babbel. Babbel is the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions. And thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy bite-sized language lessons, you'll finally be able to discover the wonder that comes with learning a new language. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes a day to complete a lesson. So you can start having real-life conversations in a new language as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans. Babbel lessons were created by over 150 language experts and voiced by real native speakers, not computers. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective, and with Babbel, you can choose from up to 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Plus, Babbel speech recognition technology helps you improve your pronunciation and accent. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to the lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. And it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. So start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, get up to 55% off your subscription when you go to babbel.com/citizen. That's babbel.com/citizen for up to 55% off your subscription. Babbel, language for life. This episode is brought to you by ghostbed.com/drinkitbros. Ghostbed. It's the best bed in the world. It's the most comfortable. Sheets, pillows, the whole thing. I've got them all, man. And, you know, they wanted to extend their best possible offer to Drink It Bros. They've been with us for a very long time. So this is the email they sent us. We want Drink It Bros to get the best offer, so I updated the code for 50% site-wide. That's 50% site-wide. Use the code Drinkin' Bros. Drinkin' Bros with no G. For 50% off site-wide. Everything that you buy on this site is going to be 50% off. Again, they get the best pillows, sheets, mattresses. They get the mattress protector if you're sloppy and spill things and you don't want to jack up your mattress. They have pretty much everything you need. They've got weighted blankets now. They've got the adjustable base, which we really like. I've got one in my home. So go to ghostbed.com/drinkitbros. Use the code drinkitbros for 50% off site-wide, and don't forget about their pay-as-you-go plan. If you're with approved credit, you're going to be able to pay this thing off over the course of 3 to 5 years for $25 to $35 a month. It's nothing. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkitbros today and use the code drinkitbros for 50% off. This episode is also brought to you by blackriflecoffee.com, the best coffee in the world. As a matter of fact, they won both the gold and bronze medal at the Golden Bean Awards this year for their exclusive coffee club entries in the elite category. So the best coffee on earth literally was Circus Bear by Black Rifle, one of their ECS. So I recommend that you go sign up for the Black Rifle Coffee Club. Use the code CITIZEN. You're going to get those points off. And, you know, you get all the benefits for being in the coffee club. You get the free shipping. You get access to all the partner deals. You get access to the exclusive coffee club. You get access to any new products that come out before anybody else does. You know, it's a very large club that they have over there, and the coffees are premium. Every single one of them is good. You're going to get experience for you. You can do just the plain coffee club, and if you want your 2 bags of espresso or your 2 bags of silencer smooth or whatever it is you drink, you can get those 2 bags or 1 bag or whatever you want every month, or rather, you can use the ECS, the Exclusive Coffee Club, and get access to some of the most premium coffees on the planet and kind of learn what it is that you like. You know what I mean? So then you can order those premium coffees from Black Rifle as well. So, and we all know they got the best branding, the best merch, and they're buddies. You know, we're all friends here. We love Black Rifle. So go to blackriflecoffee.com, sign up for the coffee club, or buy something, do whatever you want. Use the code citizen, you're going to get those points off. This episode is brought to you by firstform.com/citizen. Free shipping on all orders over $75 when you use the link. And you're not going to spend less than $75. I mean, they get the best products in the world, especially the OptiGreens. You know me, I don't eat vegetables because they're fucking pointless. So I supplement with OptiGreens 50 from First Form. It is precisely formulated green superfood powder meant for overall immune system support and digestive health. It's really good, aside from just getting the daily greens into your body that you need. And make sure, by the way, you're taking this with MCT, because you have to take anything like this with MCT. 80% of your immune system is located in your gut and your digestive tract, right? So healthy digestion is essential for overall health and wellness, not to mention that most of your serotonin, I think 96% of your serotonin or 94%, is made in your gut as well. So you're going to be in a better mood. You're going to feel better physically, and you're going to feel better mentally if you are taking these greens. OptiGreen 50 has 50 chosen ingredients, effectively dosed. It's not necessarily how many ingredients there are, though, but it's about the right amount of each. Taste and texture, no, like no other product in the market. It's not gritty. It doesn't have a weird flavor. It's got sweet berry flavors, actually. 100% of the greens are all grown and manufactured inside the United States, and they are bioavailable. Now, they've got other products as well. They've got the Microfactor, which you see behind me on every show, and I take them every day. You know, you got essential fatty acids, CoQ10. You got all the stuff you need in one little packet for your daily vitamin pack. And you mix that, you make yourself OptiGreens 50 shake, and you take those pills with it, and you're going to improve your life precipitously. You're going to feel better. You're going to look better, so on and so forth. So go to firstform.com. That's 1STPHORM.com/citizen. Use the code. You're going to get free shipping on all orders over $50.
And in 06, we had more forces in the city, and I worked for 11 BCT, and I got farmed out to a couple different army units, Task Force 19 Infantry, Manchu, love them, 177 Armor, Steel Tigers, and they used the Marines, as I write about in my book, as this blunt instrument of war, where these commanders like, holy crap, Scott's got how many Marines? I had 200... And 59 Marines soldiers and sailors in my company at the time. And I was pulling guys left and right, sitting on the FOB. I'm like, what do? You look like a strange Ranger. Like, oh, I'm a PSYOPs guy. And we take them. So I think our company strength grew to over 300. And that really allowed the Army to, I mean, those soldiers that were sitting in place out there, they were down to about 80. To 90 soldiers per company. And here I come in rolling in with all these Marines. So I kind of look like a rock star.
Yeah. I mean, for comparison's sake, an infantry company in the Army should be about 160 people.
Yeah.
So you're looking at like half strength, maybe 55%.
Yeah, because they had been taking it so hard in Ramadi over the past 8 months when 19 Infantry had been there. And then they stayed probably that long out, even after we left and transitioned over the west part of the country. But they had suffered so many casualties and, you know, dead and wounded. It was an eye opener for sure. I mean, you know, when you think about fighting in the city, and you know, Sadr City, man, that place was a,
we took fire from the moment we crossed the boundary until the moment we left every single time, no matter what time of day it was. I've never seen anything like that before in my life.
No,
it was wild as
hell. No, it was going on in a lot of places, in 06, 07. And, you know, we were just really fortunate to have great soldiers that we were fighting alongside. And Chuck Ferry was the task force commander, and he just gave me a lot of responsibility, but also a lot of autonomy to operate a little bit differently, a little more independently. And they provide us with a ton of support. But it was I'll tell you this, to be honest, as successful we were, it would not have been that way if it wasn't for the leadership at every level. And I'm talking from young sergeants and corporals to the lieutenants that we have, that was their first time in the Marine Corps and then the first time being in combat after graduating from IOC. But it was they took care of each other and me, man, better than anything I've ever experienced in my life.
Yeah, it was that 2004 period was pretty rough in both Fallujah and Ramadi. I think 2004 was in Ramadi.
Yeah,
in that first time. And then, was it 1-5 maybe? that was in Fallujah. I don't remember who it was, but they were it was different back then. So a bunch of those guys that were in Fallujah got charged, or they got investigated, never charged, for walking through buildings and double tapping bodies and shit. Because their buddy a couple of days ago had gotten blown up by a fucking half dead guy with a grenade under him, right? He rolled over and popped a pen and blew the room up. It's like, Nelson was the guy's name. I can't remember his first name, but I remember his last name. He got charged, but they dropped the charges. But it was like, do you not know what a limit of advance is? Like, we're clearing buildings here. Until I walk past him, I can still shoot him. He's an enemy combatant until I walk past him. That's what the rule says.
Yeah.
But it was weird how I would have expected. I know NCIS is different than other branches of military justice, or if you want to call it that, but that was really bizarre to me that military prosecutors would come after an infantry guy for going through a house shooting already dead bodies. That was weird. Like, I don't know. We were trying to win the PR war still then or some shit. I don't know what the fuck that was about.
Yeah, I think that from the big picture, we definitely took off the iron fist and slipped on the velvet glove way too soon in the process of the war. You know, when it comes to war crimes and how young men operate and women operate on the battlefield, I think that when things like that happen, fundamentally, it's a leadership failure and an accountability of leadership. And there's plenty of other stories throughout, you know, 20 years of war that we've endured that we can take note of. You know, there was, you know, the Gallagher trial, Fred Galvin, the MARSOC 7, you know, all guys I know too. And, you know, there's also instances where I think that, you know, as a professional soldier, let's just say you take a detainee, once you put the cuffs on someone, that human life becomes your responsibility. Sure, yeah. And you are working on the battlefield in those situations under such limited information. If we'd allowed soldiers in any way, shape, or form to become judge, jury, and executioner, once you have someone in custody, I think any parent wouldn't want their kid to be doing that. I know you want to give them the autonomy and freedom to come home and survive and have lethality on the battlefield, but it's the same thing if, you know, God forbid your kid would be put in handcuffs. Like, that doesn't give cops the authority to do whatever they want to them. It's the same rules that apply for the law of war and the basic rules of engagement or you know, fundamental rule of law is that's how we have to operate on the battlefield. And there are certain environments where it is really restrictive that frustrate people at a lot of different levels. We were very fortunate in Ramadi in 06 that we had very few restrictions. Our rules of engagement were very permissive because everybody in the city of over 300,000 people were essentially deemed the enemy.
Yeah.
So it was,
I mean, it becomes a big problem, I think, when you try to get warriors to be cops.
Absolutely.
And that happened to us in the 05 period. I would say mid 04 to 05 period, and it happened again towards the end of the surge as well. Like, they're like, all right, we've demoralized the enemy, now we're going to get black. Because we Westerners think in these very myopic short-term goal setting things, like, yeah, we elect a new president every 4 years, these people are still going to believe what they believe 1,000 years from now, right? So you can't fight them that way. It doesn't make sense.
You hit the nail on the head. I it's a great reminder to Americans and our American hubris that, you know, we as Marines especially, we're really good at a lot of things. One of them is blowing stuff up. You know what we're really bad at? Building stuff up. And throughout this war in Iraq and Afghanistan, we never had a plan at the outset for this. And Americans with their, you know, that American hubris and our piddly 250-year existence, we thought we were going to roll into a culture that's been around for 4,000 years and change it with American democracy. Well, you know, I've talked about this with several friends.
Well, it's because we thought we did it in the Marshall Plan and we did it in Japan, right?
Yeah, we were absolutely the worst students of history, too, because we did not learn from those lessons in the European theater, in the Pacific.
Well, they were already a lot like us. I mean, Japan was feudalist. Europe was feudalist. That's something that a democratic structure can work with, right? Because there's some level of democracy, even though it's concentrated at the governor or warden level or whatever you want to call it. That infrastructure exists. people in the Middle East had no idea what individual liberty meant. You can't force somebody to believe that shit if they don't already believe it.
You can't. And the other thing, too, is a lot of people think it's American democracy. It's like, no, there's no such thing as American democracy or French democracy. It's just democracy. There's one flavor, and it has to be seeded and rooted and cultivated in the culture. But if the culture doesn't want it, that's where we came into a lot of problems. And Afghanistan, which was apples and oranges from Iraq, as far as development goes, it's really hard. And I wrote about this in Echo and Ramai too, is that you've got the wrong people for the wrong jobs teaching the wrong lessons to people about governance and infrastructure and how to do that in a country where at best you're talking to a tribal leader who's 35, 45 years old in some cases, that doesn't even know what a globe is. He doesn't even understand about the earth, let alone where he's at on a map. So when you're trying to do that, I think that, again, as American hubris, we always want things so fast. We want fast food. We want fast cash at an ATM. We want fast democracy in the Middle East. But they never really devoted a plan to do that, to go back in and build things back up like they did in the Pacific theater after World War II or in the European theater.
I mean, we still have bases in Europe and Japan.
Yep. Yep.
We still provide economic aid to both of those places now. You know what I mean? It's like,
absolutely. And the one fundamental thing that you need to have for democracy to survive is great economic throughput. Mm. And you didn't see that happening in the Middle East or Afghanistan. And let's face it, Afghanistan is never going to be Sweden. It's never going to provide us with anything that we need as far as any sort of commerce. It just wasn't. But Iraq was a different story. So I wrote this article in as I was leaving the theater in 07. It's called Walmart Wins the War or something, where you just didn't see those people like titans of industry like Walmart or Home Depot going over showing these kids in the Middle East that there's more to life than just a soccer ball, and you can get your teeth fixed and eyes fixed at Walmart and have a halal cheeseburger or whatever it is. But no one in America, from the economic standpoint or from an industrial standpoint, wanted to plant a flag in Iraq. And I agree with you. I think when kids were rolling out of boot camp now, they should have been talking to each other like, where are you getting stationed? Oh, I'm going to Stuttgart, Germany, or I'm going to Okinawa, Japan, or I'm going to Al-Assad, Iraq, where we left the footprint, not as occupiers, but to stay there and show them what right looks like. And we failed to do that. And here we are 20 plus years later with really nothing to show for it. And I think that creates a lot of anxiety for especially a lot of the guys that fought on the ground, like door kickers and even the pilots that were flying over supporting us.
I mean, it took me 20 minutes of landing in country and performing operations to realize that we weren't doing a goddamn thing there. You know what I mean? I mean, we were stirring up the hornet's nest. We were having some fun, to be honest, as a psychopath. You know, I'm having a good time over there, but we had these Fox News reporters embedded with us, and I'm like pulling security, and this woman's behind me asking me questions, and she's like, oh, what do you think about this? I'm like, I don't think you can force somebody at gunpoint to believe the way you can. All they're going to do is fight back forever. And she was like, all right, cut.
I will say that, you know, that's a very pessimistic attitude that a lot of soldiers had. I'm not saying you personally, but I'm probably labeled as a pragmatic optimist on most days. And, you know, as we fought, even in Ramadi, this city of over 300,000 that was literally boiling over and spilling into the burners every single day we fought, we did it amongst the people, the men and women and children that had nowhere to go. And they weren't collateral damage. They were people. I mean, they helped us on some days. They fed us hot chai at night. They gave us blankets to keep us warm in their houses, even after we kicked them out and used it as a hasty firm bases were patrolling through the city. But they just wanted to grow up and, you know, see their kids go to school and drive a car for the first time. So it's a very dynamic situation, especially in urban combat, which will be the future of all combat as we move forward to really deal with that and then compartmentalize it as you're fighting and surviving and then figure out, well, what do I do with all this now?
Yeah. Well, the complexity of it is, I guess, supposed to be a guardrail to not go into the act all willy-nilly, for lack of a better phrase, right? Like how difficult it is to accomplish should give people pause to reflect on whether or not we can actually accomplish what we're setting out to accomplish. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's this uniquely American mission creep over the years. I don't know. I've never seen it in another country before where an entire industry pops up around a problem and then the problem must persist. Otherwise, the industry goes away. And I'm talking about the military-industrial complex, but I'm also talking about social justice warriors and breast cancer awareness and all this other bullshit, like teachers' unions. These industries pop up around around a particular problem that we want to solve. Feminism is another one. Then we solve the problem, more or less, but the industry must persist. So we have to find new forms of racism, new forms of feminism, new forms of nation building we need to go do, or whatever the fuck else, right? It's like the purpose, I guess, of the complexity of the situation is to remind us that we can't do all these things. We haven't figured out how to cross the finish line. You know what I mean? We just don't. I don't know. I don't understand. Well, I know why we can't, because people are making money off of it. That's the short answer. But it's deeper than that, because there's buy-in from the people as well. It's not just about the corporate interest. People want that as well.
Well, we never really defined what winning was. And
definitely not in either one of these two wars. I mean, what would it have been? The Taliban ruling the country, I guess, right?
Well, at the administrative level, winning was never defined. And mm-hmm. and that was a problem for the individual soldier and Marine on the ground, too, is how do you articulate that to them as a commander and let them know what they're doing every single day, risking their lives, mm-hmm. surviving day in and day out is worth it.
Yeah. Beyond it being worth it, though, like when you run a business, you have a mission statement, right? At Black Rifle, our mission statement was, we provide coffee and culture to people who love America, right? So the general idea behind that is, no matter what department you work in, when you're doing your job, is what I'm doing and how I'm doing it, does it support that particular mission? And when you give even the lowest private, like, hey, this is the end state that we're looking for, then he knows that they're not idiots. They're making conscious decisions to support that end state because they want to fucking go home. You know what I mean? And you're like, if you don't give them that, it was pretty obvious in World War II. Kill Hitler, and we're out, right?
Well, in 06, 07, our mission was kill or capture
fuck shit up,
anti-radic right? fighters. Yeah. That was it. It was pretty simple. But I think even with the failed withdrawal in Afghanistan, and again, those wars are two completely separate, and I was in both of them, in both theaters, but I think it was important to remind people, too, that not only the soldiers and Marines that fought and everybody else, but America, is that, you know, we tried to give the peace-loving people of those cultures hope. And I think with more buy-in from the administrative level, I think we might have succeeded. But you can't guarantee an education for an Afghan girl and then pull out wholesale and just leave them, because it goes back to exactly how it was. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you diminish that hope, you erode the credibility of our country abroad. So when we come back to those regions, and hopefully we won't have to soon, but I mean, if you can look at the political and social landscape now, it's always a 10-year cycle, man. You get it. It's a sine wave of war and post-war, and it goes back and forth. And you know, for me, it's hard to believe that the Battle of Ramadi is coming up on a 20-year anniversary. It really does fly by fast, but we've managed to really honor the people that fought in those wars and share their stories, I think, is important. It's important to stay tied into the veteran community. And again, at the beginning and end of every day, if you're not waking up trying to help someone beside yourself, I think it's all for naught, man, honestly. Yeah.
Well, that's the one thing that kind of, whether you were, you know, in the military or some other kind of service, that's the thing that I believe attracts all of us to one another. I mean, you hear the phrase military and first responder used a lot, right? As if the two were interchangeable. Now, they're very different jobs, obviously. but this instinctual predilection to help other people and use your strength to protect them, I think, is something that kind of has defined the best in humanity, you know, as long as we've been a species. And it's something that gets weaponized against us a lot, I think, right? Like, you use that honor and integrity for your own benefit a lot, not you, but like the government likes to do that stuff. But it doesn't matter. And I say that because a lot of people become disaffected, black-pilled, whatever the fuck you want to call it now. That is loser bullshit, by the way. That's just like you're quitting. Like Sigma, all the Sigma male bullshit where it's like, oh, girls were mean to me back in the day, so women don't matter anymore. It's like, shut the fuck up, dude, you fat retard. but there is, as much as I am critical of that position, it is a problem, right? That people are, as you say, internationally, but even domestically, losing faith in the idea that is America, right? And all the things that we took Western civilization. We're like, hey, we like this. We don't like this. We like masculinity. We like individual liberty. We like freedom of speech. We like the right to protect ourselves. We don't like feudalism. We don't like kings, blah, 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 right? We don't like censorship. So we tried to take all the things we like and make it an idea that is a country that should be resilient against all these external forces. And here we find ourselves captured by them once again, you know? And I feel like it is our failure, frankly, that that's happened. But the only way we can fail, you mentioned it before, the success of a lot of these military operations happened because of the courage and professionalism of lower enlisted people. But our job is to train and empower those motherfuckers, right? Sergeants win wars. That's how it works.
Yeah.
And if we don't train our sergeants and give them both the autonomy and power to fucking do that shit, then that's our failure. It looks like they're failing, but really it's us.
Yeah. Well, what you're talking about too really kind of works its way into what we're dealing with right now. The biggest battle we're facing right now militarily is this recruiting crisis. Mm. And the Army failed to recruit 22,000 last year. The Navy, 10. Air Force, 10. They sat in front of Congress in March, and the Air Force flat out said, yeah, we're not going to make it this year again. And the Marine Corps barely squeaked by, and I can't believe they were even bragging about it. 21. There were 21 recruits over. But they're not talking about the retention problems too. And if this is interesting, because guys like me who also have kids, we're not telling our kids to join the military for the benefits of military service. And that is not an indictment on serving in the military. Mm. That's a real indictment from guys like me who are legacy holders that kid should be an easy number for a recruiter to roll. Yep. When the parent walks him in. But there's a lack of faith in the administrative level. The politics of this country always talking about each other instead of talking about how to help the country. And I think that's something that really bothers us as military leaders, because we do take all of those tenets and principles of leadership to heart.
Yeah.
We eat last, you know, just like you have in your mantra on your website. It's like, it's just something we do. And I always remind people as well, all the deployments and all the fighting I've done, there is absolutely no such thing as combat leadership, just leadership.
Yeah.
You either lead or you do not lead. And I think I'm very fortunate to be in a position now where I can continue to lead and people ask me to do that. I think it's a real privilege. Mm. But I also understand that whether you do 4 years in the military or 24 years, not everybody has the capacity to continue to do that. Mm. Not everybody has the drive to do that. And I think that having that capacity it's helped me. I think that as an older guy dealing with a lot of trauma throughout my whole life, that just staying that busy always helps. And now I'm in a position too where I kind of reflect on it. And I'm pretty grateful for all that as well.
And Jared Taylor and I were talking about this the other day about the legacy recruits and that being one of the biggest problems. So I would say, He and I had a long discussion about this. I'd like to get your thoughts on it. I don't know that we have a recruiting crisis. I think we have an identity and purpose crisis, not just amongst the kids. I mean, amongst the leadership and the military and the government, right? It's like if the identity of the service member and the purpose, you know, that they serve specifically in this time and place were good, we would have no problem sending our kids into that, because that's what we want for them, is to live a life of service, right?
Yeah.
And they've robbed us of that opportunity, I feel like. Like, how do you...
Who robbed it? Who's the robber, though?
Like, well, I mean, circumstances.
General officers, politicians.
I would say politicians are number one, and weak, cowardly general officers who are career politicians are probably a close second,
I think, frankly. I think there's some truth to that. I think there's a lot of ways to to look at the and it is a crisis.
It's a crisis either definition. Way. Sure, yeah.
Because this is well, first let me answer the robber part. I think there are thieves within the military, the senior officer level, that once they're promoted to general officers, they quickly snap into the role of politician. Mm. And then there's politicians using the military for the wrong reasons. So that's where you have senior officers, senior enlisted leaders, really at odds with their service in the military because they don't like how the politicians are using and implementing the military. So they've questioned the last 20 years of service in some cases. But I think that from a recruiting standpoint is there's so many hurdles in front of these recruiters. And instead of sitting around the VFW, by the way, and trying to complain about the problem all day, Dan, I got introduced to a guy who started this revolutionary tech company called RevyPro in San Diego. And Ivan calls me up, and it was really just a friendly conversation. He talks about how he migrated to America from Ireland, and he's been a citizen now for 10 years. So this boils over to this love of country and patriotism discussion. I says, hey, man, so tell me about this tech. And so he goes into this, and it's this revolutionary platform that's secure, controlled content. Imagine Indeed meets TikTok, and it's talking to the Zoomers and Gen Y. Because that, from a recruiting standpoint, is the biggest problem is guys like me, at least in my generation, you're not Gen X. You're
I'm on the board. Are you on I was born in 81.
Oregon so Trail. So, yeah, you're right on the cusp. Mm-hmm. But especially guys in the military, I think I was talking to Mark, actually, in Dallas. And I was talking about this recruiting crisis. Mm-hmm. And, he was complaining about millennials and, Gen Z. I said, man, you can't be one of those old graybeards that says, I walked uphill both ways in the snow to school. I said, because now you're part of the problem. Mm-hmm. So this tech, as I start to unfold it, I said to Ivan, I said, hey, man, you should really think about getting this in front of the military. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, Scotty, do you know anybody? I said, well, as a matter of fact, I do. So since February, we've gotten this technology in front of every senior enlisted leader up to the chairman, joint chiefs of staff, and every C-suite level officer and sergeant major, operations officer from U.S. Army Recruiting Command to U.S. Navy Recruiting, BUPERS, United States Marine Corps Recruiting Command, because this tech is really targeting Gen Z and not even millennials. It's got to be Gen Z and Gen Y.
Yeah.
And it is creating a bridge to cover those gaps. So I'll use the Marine Corps example. They spend $300 million a year on their advertising agency. And during COVID, when the recruiting numbers were really suffering, what their answer was? Well, it's COVID. Well, what happens when there's another pandemic? And there will be in some way, shape, or form. How do you bridge that gap to continue to recruit 18-year-old kids? I'm telling you, it's not billboards on I-10 or Super Bowl commercials because they don't even watch commercials. And you have to be of the mindset to understand that these generations receive, consume, and digest and then process information differently than every other generation because we're living in the information age.
Right.
And if senior graybeard recruiters, commanders, senior enlisted leaders can't adopt to that, I really see that this crisis is going to continually grow. And, it's only a matter of time before a near-peer adversary wants to pick a fight with us. Sure. And you know what? We never want a fair fight, period.
Yeah.
Well, so we have to keep the advantage.
Because of our Navy and Air Force, we never will. But still, it's dangerous to think that way.
Well, you got China playing chicken with U.S. Navy warships in the Pacific. I think it's...
they don't have Trident subs, though.
No, they don't. But God forbid it would come to, launching some of those tubes.
I don't think... Yeah, fuck that.
Yeah.
Fuck that, because then it's all hell breaks loose. But the B-21's coming up soon, too. That's going to be nice.
Yeah.
I think for the first time in the history of the military... The U.S. military recruiters are, and the more so than the ground level recruiter, the recruiting command and the advertising part are actually having to do their jobs. Because for the most part, it's been done for them a lot.
But they're not leveraging technology. The way you were recruited in the Army in 2004, 2005, it's the same way they're doing it. I was recruited in 1988, and they're still doing it with business cards and pull-up bars. Yeah. You can't get in front of a 17-year-old kid who lives on his iPhone with a business card.
Well, 9/11 helped.
Well, to God forbid we should have to park a few planes into buildings to light the fuse on American patriotism. You know, it would be a sad day.
What concerns me is if it happened again right now, I don't think the response would be the same amongst the generation that I was in.
You're not the first person to make that, to think about that.
I mean, because look at what's going on now. Israel gets attacked and everybody blames Israel. It's like, all right. I mean, look, they have plenty of problems like everybody else. Bibi Netanyahu is a fucking crazy person that's trying to get rid of the judicial branch of government over there. Got it. But that doesn't have anything to do with Hamas murdering a bunch of civilians. And I feel like if America got attacked today, a very large portion of our youth would be blaming us for it. I mean, look at how many people jumped onto this stupid Bin Laden trend on TikTok. I'm like, oh, he's got some good ideas. Like, no, he doesn't. He referenced
one more quote. Reason I'm not on TikTok.
I know. He referenced a quote from fucking Ben Franklin that didn't exist. It's like, oh, good. Bin Laden used ChatGPT to fucking write his Wikipedia-based article, and now you guys are falling for it. Just because you hate – that's when there's an identity crisis in this country. You know what I mean? When you and I were in high school, no matter what was going on with us, whether we were, disaffected or depressed or angry or the fucking captain of the football team, somebody asked us what it means to be an American, we would have had an answer for that immediately, right? And kids today will not have an answer for that.
Well, that's a pretty generalized, pessimistic.
I've asked a lot of them.
I think that
their kids in certain part of the country will definitely have an answer.
I like to think that there is greatness in every generation. I'm never being accused of being a generationalist. I think that
it's not about that. But we fucked them over is the problem. I don't blame the kids.
We're saturating them with so much misinformation and negative information. And this goes all the way from the user level, from a social media platform, all the way to mainstream media when... Yeah. If you're a young kid and your mom and dad have the news on and they see the politics on TV, it's nothing but infighting. It's nothing but negative messaging. So, try and wind the clock back, man. If you were a 16, 17-year-old kid, would you want to be involved in politics or have a huge sense of patriotism? I agree with you. We are part of the problem. And the real question and challenge and call to action to people who listen to this show or even us in the studio is how do you continue to inspire the next generation? Because it's your responsibility. It's a tough question. What do you do? Where do I go? Who do I talk to? And I'll tell you what, I was up in the Reagan Ranch Center talking to a whole room full of like 300 high school kids. Like, that's a pretty uncomfortable position for me. As a 50-year-old guy, you got to stand in front of a bunch of high school kids. So my teachers get so much of my, praise and to do that job every single day. But as an outsider to go and try and do that, man, that's a million-dollar question.
Yeah. Well, we got to spend a little bit more time or a little less time being reactionary. Everybody wants to defend their position instead of explain their position. I think that's a problem. Yeah. Right? And it's a problem that's been brought on by the, tumult, I guess, from the 24-hour news cycle. Everybody's kind of forced to have a strong opinion on things that have nothing to do with them even sometimes, right? Like, oh, you don't feel this way about that? What's your problem? Like, I don't give a fuck about that, dude. Just like, you want to talk about sports or what? Yeah. You know what I mean? But
the other thing, too, is there's so much – I mean, think about just the coverage of the wars and then – I was talking to some guys in the nonprofit space about all. I said, "Man, look, we have to change the messaging. Like all of this darkness and boozy vets and drowning guys in combat gear and amputees across Super Bowl commercials." I said, how are we? This is a very direct and indirect impact on our military recruiting establishment because what 17-year-old kid is going to say, "Yeah, I'm going to go join the Marines and serve my country, get blown up, maybe lose a leg, and then I get to live under a bridge. Where do I sign?" Like, no one is going to do that. So how do we change the messaging to the positive benefits of military service and let them know that you can do 4 years or 24 years and the benefits far outweigh the negative stuff? And you're in a great position of responsibility to do that. So am I. Yeah. When you're out in front of large groups or you have a microphone and you can influence people like that, you got to tell them about all the great stuff.
Well, I'm not going to do that because I don't think they should join the military right now. And I don't think you do either because you just said you wouldn't take your kid down there to join, right?
I would be hard-pressed to push her towards military service.
Same. And I don't want to tell other people's kids that either right now because I think it's kind of fucked. I mean, so, like the situation, not telling them. If we were doing shit that mattered, and we do, like, there's a lot of stuff the military still does that matters. I'm not going to be a pessimist about that. But if I didn't have a gut feeling that this or a future administration was going to send my buddies off to die again for no fucking reason, I would be pretty gung-ho about getting people to join the military, not just because of what it will do for the country, but for what it does for them to serve, right? It makes the greatest generation was made great, not because they were great, because of their fucking service. That's what made them great, right? It took a bunch of young men and turned them into fucking great men, right? And it benefited our country greatly. So you start ground up. That's how we always like to build. I would tell them in a heartbeat, go do this thing, it will make you better, right? And then as a result, it'll make our country better. So now I tell people to go join the sheriff's department or something. You know what I mean? So I don't know how, like, I agree that the messaging needs to change because people aren't, it's not going to get better unless we put the right people in charge, right? And you can't put the right people in charge unless they start off at the lowest pot, right? So it's kind of a fucked up cycle that we're in right now.
Well, I'm not anti-military, and I'd not dissuade my kid from joining the military. The level of enthusiasm has waned a little bit because of how they're used. But there are a lot of different ways you can serve. You don't have to be jumping on airplanes or kicking doors in your mind.
I mean, it's funny. Country. It's fun, more fun that way, to be honest.
But, it is.
You know.
But at the end of the day, all we get is bragging rights.
It's true. You know. Bragging rights and fucking
I never liked being cold. I know, like, being wet, I never like getting up early. So really bad career choice for me.
Join the Air Force.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all I'll say about that. They're not.
That's all you get out of this bragging rights.
Yeah.
So.
But we have, to your point about the messaging, though, we have an issue with gun violence, and we blame the guns. We have an issue with improperly prosecuted wars, and we blame the troops, you know, or service or whatever. We have this. I don't know if it's the West or if it's just weak human beings that continuously push the blame as far downstream as possible instead of looking upstream for root causes.
Yeah.
Maybe because it's harder, maybe because there's a lot of industry between root and stem. I don't know.
I think you're right because even in the military, which we're talking largely about today, is even those violations of rules of engagement or law of war, how we practice our profession, the real sad part of all this too, that eroded a lot of credibility, is you didn't see any senior officers or any general officers getting relieved or resigning or getting fired for the actions of those people that they ultimately commanded. There has never been any ownership of that. So I agree with you that, you know, that ownership needs to start at the top and go down, not the other way around, because that's an uphill battle, especially when you're talking about how you take your whole career of military service and then transition to what we do now to continue to inspire young people to say, man, you should join the Marine Corps. And it's tough.
Yeah,
it makes it more challenging even for guys like us.
I mean, to be honest, I would be more keen on telling somebody to join the Marine Corps than the Army at this point, because you're going to be on a mew. You're going to exfil some people from a bad situation more likely than I am. Like, I'm in the 82nd. These days, maybe I'll take over an airfield or something like that, right? Or go do Force Pro somewhere. But if you want to do something meaningful, I think the Marine Corps is probably the best. If you're a ground pounder, if you're
it's all timing though.
It is. You never know. Because then you join in fucking the late 2000s, you end up in fucking Iraq or Afghanistan.
It is. Be careful what you ask for.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify?
Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get it. I remember when they
don't join for college money. Don't do that. That's a mistake. Unless you join the Air Force, then it's fine.
They all have pretty good college programs, though.
Yeah, I'm just saying the Air Force, you're not going to end up in a fucking sleep outside somewhere. You'll get hot chow three times a day.
Yeah. We saw with Saddam getting pulled out of his spider hole, and I thought, oh man, there goes my war, man. I'm not going to get another deployment. Yeah. And like five deployments later, I'm be careful what you ask for.
Tell me about the book. Tell me the story that this is the book here. It's Echo and Ramadi. Tell me about this. Tell me why you wrote it and what's in it.
Well, it's really not a war story. It's I wrote it from a historical perspective, and despite the fact that you can see the image there, it's a Marine, looks like he's going to kick your door down in the middle of the night and do bad things to you, which we are absolutely well trained to do. It's really a story about this power of human connection and people and the best and brightest of our country who are thrown together under the worst circumstances in a city that was full of uncertainty and certain danger all the time. And it's a story about, this love of one another and the connection we have. And that includes and is extended to the brave Iraqi citizens and my interpreters that fought under my command and the families that supported us and our Gold Star families who lost sons and daughters throughout the last 20 years of war. And I think it's a story about leadership at every level and how those young guys really just perform these superhuman acts every single day. And man, I tell you, they never failed to astound me. And
I tell people that all the time. That are trying to, I guess, empathize, like, oh, you guys must have had it rough there. I'm like, yeah, I saw the worst shit you can see, but I saw the best shit you can see too, right? So it's not all bad. I mean, it's a bad situation, but, you know, character gets revealed in extreme situations. Yeah. And you see men that you respected and then you love them after. You know what I mean? It's different.
It's hard for someone that hasn't experienced that and the civilian who sees images on TV like what's going on right now in Israel. I mean, the city is just rubble, and that's the environment we lived and operated in for months and months on end. But it's hard for people to comprehend that there's so many beautiful things that are born out of war.
Yeah.
And it's not limited to the unique bonds that forge, you know, a unit on the battlefield for a lifetime. I mean, for me, I was in a lot of units in the Marine Corps, but being a company commander in Ramadi in 06 was like being the quarterback of an NFL Super Bowl team.
Yeah.
That's the level core of intensity. Memory.
That's the one that sticks with you.
Yeah. If people had to use the term pinnacle of a career, and I did 24 years, that was the pinnacle of my career. And I'd been in other deployments, other combat deployments, but that fight at that time was just, it's everything we trained for and a lot of stuff we never trained for.
Yeah.
Which was even harder at times.
Yeah, I mean, it's it was a different kind of situation because usually, like, throughout history, there have been guerrilla wars before, South America quite a bit through the 80s and 70s and 80s and 90s, guerrilla wars in the Middle East before to some degree. And then to some degree, the French fought some guerrilla campaigns against the Germans, you know, back in the day. But for it to be the entirety of the war, to like have a piece of, instead of going to Eindhoven and then to Belgium and then to down to Germany and blah blah blah, right, and just pushing through towns, I've got this 70 square mile area and I have to dominate this for a while, and behind every rock there's a gun or a bomb, right? It's fucking weird.
It's always fucking weird because
that's your neighborhood. I live here now for the next however long.
Yeah.
And that might explode. It's fucking weird. I don't know how to train somebody for that or how to rationalize that as a human being.
Training for uncertainty is and boredom is probably one of the toughest things as a commander. You just, there's no missing essential task list that says be bored. Well, yeah, we do have a program for that too in the Marine Corps. It's called duty. Iraq and Afghan vets, whenever I talk to World War II or even Korean War vets, and they're always astounded how we fought. And I always want to learn what they're doing, how they fought during these great iconic battles, but they are so quick to turn it around because, like every warrior throughout generations, like they just want to know how we did it last and make those comparisons, because the tempo and the fluidity fighting in an urban battle, especially in Ramadi in 06, 07, again, really redefined what urban fighting was and the bloodiness of it all and how much toll that takes on us because you're operating 24 hours living in the city where it was different in the Pacific.
Yeah.
It was different in Vietnam where some of these great battles, like Major General James Livingston, who wrote the foreword to my book, who's a Medal of Honor recipient, in the Battle of Dai Do in 68, I mean, there was two Medals of Honor out of 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, a couple Navy Crosses, God knows how many Silver Stars and Bronze Stars for Valor. It was a three-day battle. And it wasn't this protracted urban battle that our soldiers and Marines had to fight for the last 20 years. So it was different. But those guys, I always like comparing notes and how keenly interested they are in how the young men and women are fighting today.
Well, you know what I would be interested in is how we're going to fight next, because we've never gotten it right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not yet. And it was a big problem at the outset of this particular war because all of our field grade officers and senior NCOs had never fought like that before. And they were the ones making command and tactical decisions. And, it went as well as it could have gone, I suppose, but probably would have gone quite a bit better if the person in charge of it wasn't Paul Bremer, some statesman, right? Like if you recall throughout history, it's been people like Eisenhower in charge of the war, not some fucking dude from the Department of Homeland Security or whatever, right? It was very bizarre to me that we sent a civilian over to command that war. And say what you want about him, he was there for the rebuilding process or whatever the fuck. No, he was there to fucking tell generals what to do. We've never, ever in the history of warfare done that. And I think that's like, it kind of shows you, like to what your point before, we never had a real goal there. Not a well spelled out one anyways. It shows you how dumb we were about prosecuting this particular war. And my concern is, along with, if you want to call it the recruiting crisis, along with that, are we prepared in the same way that our near peers are to fight the new kind of war, whatever it happens to be? Can we fight an insurgency against somebody that's close to us, for example, that has a bunch of their people embedded in our country already, for example, right?
I think we can. I think it's just like that sine wave of peace and war I mentioned earlier, is that organizationally we lose that resident knowledge. All of the sergeants, these 22-year-old kids who fought under my command in Ramadi, they're all retiring now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been, 17 years, 18 years since that fight. All the officers.
How does that make you feel, by the way, that all of your junior enlisted guys are now retiring?
I love it. I love it. They grew up so fast. But being connected to them, though, is I get invited to the promotion ceremonies or the retirement ceremonies even. And I've been retired next month for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
That's hard to believe. And but I still do stay very connected to those Marines. And I love it. It always puts a smile on my face. And, one of the things I like to remind them, too, as they transition is not only the fact that those guys who are peers and stayed on active duty, like I remind them, like, look, man, you're going to have to unpack some of this somehow. Mm. And we're here for each other. And The other thing I like to remind people too, that I was talking to a good friend of mine. I don't know if you know Josh Montz. Did you ever read Beauty of a Darker Soul?
I don't think so, no.
So I was with Josh in Vegas 2 weeks ago at MCON with Waco Hoover. And I just had burrito with Josh and Pete Turner, who hosts the Break It Down Show podcast. And Josh, a pretty deep dude who was shot through the femoral artery from a bullet that went through the neck of his platoon sergeant, killed him.
Damn.
Josh was down for not one, not two, not 5 minutes, 12 minutes flatlined. And so I said, man, we got to call Josh and check in on him because he's working on his PhD in Vegas. And I was reminded to call him, thanks to Pete, because we were talking to Sebastian Younger. Mm. And Sebastian was telling me about this book he's coming out with. I said, oh, your new book's coming out. I'm like, yeah, we got it on the show. And it's about his near-death experience because he lost like 5 quarts of blood from this, you know, condition he had. And so he writes about it. And Sebastian's just, you know, he's in the 20-pound brain club.
He's a very good writer.
Oh, yeah. He's amazing. And I love having conversations with him, too, because it can be anything from sophomoric banter to like some deep dives. But I said, hey, you got to read Josh's book. And Josh talks about his near-death experience. I said, man, you did not have a near-death experience.
You had a death experience.
No, he's got a zombie experience, man. There is no reason that guy should be alive.
12 minutes is well beyond brain damage.
Yeah.
That's fucked. I mean, good for him, though.
So, the Army used Josh as a conduit for public speaking and talking throughout his journey. And then, he went through every type of modality from farm to psychedelics to now he's into this deep breathing and yoga and really finding out where he is centered as he goes through this process. And he goes out to Death Valley and he admires all of these little microclimates after a rain. And so it's a really deep burrito, man. Like this is the most deep dive burrito we have between me, Pete, and Josh. And he has never gotten a brain scan too, by the way. All these doctors have never sent him to get brain scans, but now he's centered. And he says to me, he goes, yeah, I'm not getting the brain scan. My brain is fine. I said, yeah, but through all this catharsis with all the stuff and all the badness and trauma boiling out of the surface, does any of the happiness pop up along the way? And you have this thought, you're like, man, that was a good thing. And this 2 hours of deep breathing reminded me that, Josh says, I'm not a happy person. I said, yeah, but happiness is, definitions are very, yeah. He goes, I'm content. I'm a content person. And I beat him down a little more. And, I says, hey, man, you do know you got to give some of this back.
Yeah.
Like there will come a point where you have to share some of this. And I was telling him to be ready for that. And, the whole point of this story is, guys who transition to get out of the military after serving and sacrificing their lives and bodies for 20 plus years, I said, you have to be receptive too. Mm. And I said, I was riding my Harley across the country for charity 2 years ago and I hit East Texas. It starts to piss on me. The sky's gray and purple and I'm throttling down on my Harley and I'm thinking to myself, self, you are 50 years old and you've done all this cool stuff. What if I had another 50 years? And then Josh, being the 20-pound brain in the room, he says, what if that first 50 years is X? And what if the next 50 years is X plus Y? Mm-hmm. Y being experience. Mm-hmm. And you gain all this wisdom and experience, and you apply it so it shortens the actual time span it has to do good things. The whole point of the story, too, is not this esoteric discussion we're having over burritos at Roberto's, but it's to remind people, especially veterans and first responders, is that when you transition, you make it through all that trauma and all the sacrifice, you got to accept that reward.
Yeah.
That reward is the peace to not feel anxious or to appreciate nature or listening to the sound of acorns falling out of the trees as you're hunting in North Texas. And those are real rewards, and I think a lot of people struggle with accepting rewards. Like, you earned it, man.
Yeah, I was just talking
to somebody. You don't deserve anything, but you have earned that.
I was just talking to somebody about that this weekend. It's really hard for us because, for a variety of different reasons, in the moment, I guess, or closer to an event, whether it's combat or death, it's hard to appreciate what's going on around you because it almost feels like a betrayal to forget that your buddies are dead and to move on and have a good life. But that's not what they would want.
No. Right?
I mean, no, of course they wouldn't want that. You wouldn't want that if you would have been the one that died.
You've had so many people roll through the show, man. you could probably speak to this, but I've come to find out that it's not really all the seeing the worst of humanity, you know, exposed to you at such a young age, and all the things you have done and had to do at such a very young age, and to take another human life is one of those. But I think as we come back, it's all the regrets you have.
Yeah.
What if I had done this? Not really for the guys I was fighting next to in this, you know, survivor's guilt. I don't think is again, apples and oranges, but it's the things that you don't do personally. I mean, those split second decisions or that moment of fear that paralyzed you in the battlefield. I mean, let's face it, man, if you're not scared, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah, yeah.
We call those people, you know, sociopaths.
Yeah.
But we weed those guys out before they even enlist in the Marines. Mm. So it's interesting to think how those people deal with that at such a young age. I was a 35-year-old captain.
Mm.
Plenty of combat deployments and life experience, but you know, when a kid's 18, 19 years old, how they process that and then transition, be successful in life. That's why I love sharing all these stories of success with our veteran community, man, because there's so many people kicking ass out there and doing great things that are not feeling sorry for themselves.
Anyway. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, if you get anything out of this stuff, this episode, it's like, I like the XY thing. That's interesting. Like, operate with the experience that you have now, right? And then I think a really important thing to understand, not just as a former warrior, but also just as a man and human civilization, that your service is not ended because you took off your fucking uniform. It's in some ways only just begun, right?
Yeah.
Because now you're the elder in the tribe. Even if you're a fucking 30-year-old that just got out of the Army after a year enlistment, you're the elder in that tribe and that community of kids who are going to go through this and have no idea how to traverse what's coming next. Right.
There's no leadership certificate or a commission or a promotion that has an expiration date on it. And again, if you have the capacity to do that, I get it. Some guys want to hang up the rifle and they want to transition. They don't want to talk about it. That's fine. But there's plenty of others out there that are in a position that speak volumes for those who can't. And you should be, again, very privileged if you're one of those people. You are. And a lot of people that come through this is... you're inspiring, and whether you served in the military or not, you have that capacity to make a difference and be a great American. I think that is the premise of this show too, is, you know, the title of it in itself is we have to be teaching civics lessons to all of these kids we meet and to our fellow peers, you know, in the same age group, so they can continue to, you know, pick up that call to action and say, look, inspire. You know, show them the greatness of this country, because if you just open up the fire hose and turn on Fox News or CNN and that's your whole source of information, you're going to be drowning.
Yeah,
you're just going to be drowning in misery, man, because those are miserable platforms that, I mean, some are better than others, but man, they just continue to push a negativity.
Yeah. Yeah. And to that point, you know, people are going to learn more from your example than they ever learn from the shit that comes out of your mouth. You know, so you got to live that life. You got to put it on the line sometimes. Yeah, your feelings hurt today. Sorry, but I mean, I've had enough of all the coddling of veterans, and I don't mean in a way that they don't deserve some fucking attention. That's not the case. But we're dudes. Like, you're not supposed to hug us when we're upset like that. You're supposed to be like, hey, dude, it's time to fucking work. You got shit to do. Let's get this going. You know what I mean? Like, you process the trauma.
I like that.
You deal with it, but it's time to fucking get to work. Now's not the time to feel. Now's the time to do. We can handle that bullshit later. We're in a little bit of trouble as a country right now. Stop whining. Get off your ass and do something. Not just because that's what we need, is because what you need to heal yourself. That you will heal yourself. Gandhi says, if you want to lose yourself, if you want to truly find yourself, lose yourself in the service of other people, right? That's a very common theme throughout all of human history. You'll find it in the Stoics. You'll find it all throughout Western civilization. It makes a lot of sense because that's what we were built to do, right? So that's my admonition to anybody listening to this shit. If you have been part of some of these battles or one of your own battles, you're not going to find yourself in the bottom of a fucking bottle or pills. You're not going to find yourself whining in a corner somewhere. You're not going to find yourself as one of these Sigma males who have tuned out of society. The only place you will find yourself and your purpose is in the service of other people. That's my take on that. Any thoughts?
I agree 100%. I think I said it earlier, you know, if you're not helping someone else beside yourself, you know, it's all for naught. Yep. I wake up every day and try and do that. I try and subscribe to, you know, that rule of four is, you know, every day I get up and I like to read the right stuff, educate myself for time. I like to do something physical. I like to put myself in uncomfortable positions, contortion wise, but maybe it's that group of high school students or coming into a strange studio. It's like I'm driving down here from, you know, Weatherford, Texas. I'm like, man, I wonder where this studio, like, is it like a trailer park or something? I have no idea.
Well, it sort of is. There's a trailer out there.
It is kind of, it's kind of like a barn dominium type feel outside. But, and the last thing I like to do is to do something for someone else besides myself. I think if you can do that, even if you were capable of doing it for 4 hours a day, you think about that. You got another 20 hours in the day. Mm. Do whatever you want with. But the days I don't do it, I don't beat myself up either. It's like, I missed. I don't know if I really helped someone today, or I sat on the couch all day, or I didn't do something physical. But those days are very rare.
Yeah.
I think it keeps you balanced.
Yeah, it does. It keeps you balanced. Yeah. And mostly it reminds you that life's not about you. You know what I mean? The most self-centered people are going to be the most miserable always.
Yeah,
always. And it's poison.
It's not lost in me on any given day, though, too, that you know, guys like us, that we do a lot of talking, but they're in small captured periods of time, but we also do. Because there is a time for talking. You have to inspire. You have to have messaging. But there's also a time for action. And, you know, from what I've seen, this, all the guys that are in our tribe, and, you know, we could name drop for hours, but everybody's doing something.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing something to make a difference, to help someone else. And I think that's laudable. For sure.
That's the that's what's really important about it. It's what builds civilization, and it's what sustains it. Yeah. Well, look, I appreciate you coming today. This book is really good. It's called Echo and Ramadi, the firsthand story of U.S. Marines in Iraq's deadliest city, and that is Ramadi. It is very good. It's a ground pounder perspective, but also from a command level, which I don't think we've gotten about any of these major conflicts before, which is very interesting the way it was written. So I appreciate you coming today and talking about it.
Absolutely, my honor, man.
And thank you all for listening. This has been Citizen.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.